This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created. To listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and our guest today is Darlene Iskra. Darlene served in the U.S. Navy for 21 years as a diving officer, surface warfare officer, and military staff officer. She was one of the first woman officers to serve as a diving officer, and she served on four different ships before taking command of the rescue and salvage ship USS Opportune during Operation Desert Shield Storm in December 1990. She retired from the U.S. Navy as a commander in April of 2000. She attended graduate school at the University of Maryland from 1999 to 2007, where she received her Ph.D. in sociology with two specialty interests, military sociology and gender, work, and family. Dr. Iskra also holds an M.A. in National Security and Strategic Studies from the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. She was inducted into the Women Divers Hall of Fame in 2008 and the San Francisco State University Alumni Hall of Fame in 2009 for her pioneering diving career and for her being the first woman to command a ship in the Navy. Hi, Darlene. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking time to talk with us today. Now, you grew up in the Bay Area of California and graduated from college in 1974, and then you took on an internship at a USO facility. What was memorable about that experience?
Well, I can't remember exactly how I got the job, but it just seemed like my major was recreation administration, recreation specialty, like parks and recreation, that kind of thing. So the USO at the time, which was in San Francisco, had a facility where the sailors and Marines and Coast Guardsmen could come in, and it's like a recreation hall. They were able to go to that facility to get off base, which is what they really liked, even though there was all sorts of recreational facilities on base. So I just thought it would be kind of fun. So I learned how to, you know, plan events and organize, just be a little bit of a social person there.
Okay. And then now as a woman, looking at a very male-dominated profession, the armed forces, what inspired you to join the Navy in 1979?
My financial situation.
Okay, that's honest.
I had a job, but I didn't have a job with any kind of benefits. So I was starting to think about the future at 27 years old, and I was looking around for a job that offered those kinds of benefits, and the Navy just seemed like a good fit.
So you go into the Navy, and then once you're in the services, you went on to officer candidate school.
Yeah, that's the initial stop for people coming in back then. Now, as an officer assessment program, now they pretty much limit it to the NJROTC program and or the Naval Academy. Back then, they were post-Vietnam. They were really looking for people to fill the ranks. And so, yeah, I went to officer candidate school, which was a shock to my system.
Okay. What was the best part and the worst part of that experience that you remember?
Well, the best part was actually, you know, they build you up as the worst part was they tear you down as a civilian, but then the best part is when they build you back up as a naval officer. And I was able to get a lot of confidence in myself that I didn't have prior to going through all that. I was able to, you know, meet the challenges and fulfill them and actually, you know, better my expectations.
Yeah. So as in that program, you know, again, being one of the few women, I would assume, in the program at that time, how about the physical part of it? Was it really hard for you to go through that, or did you do fine?
Well, You know, the physical part actually wasn't too hard for me. Not at officer candidate school. I had been a bicyclist and a swimmer. So basically all I had to add to the mix was running, which I was not a runner. But because of my aerobic capacity due to swimming and bicycling, you know, I figured out how to run and breathe at the same time, which you really have to learn how to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Once I figured that out, you know, it all worked out. Now, the hardest physical part for me was when I know you're going to get into this, but when I went to dive school, that was really physically challenging for me.
So let's get into that right away. So you get out of candidate school, and not only did you join the Navy and go through this officer candidate program, but now you choose the Navy diving program and went to dive school. Did you know what you were getting into with that choice?
Not really. You know, it was kind of interesting because when I had made the decision to go in the Navy, I was working at a swimming pool up in as a assistant director at a swimming pool in Skagit Valley. So I was talking to a colleague who had been in the Navy, and he said, "Oh, well, you're a good swimmer. Why don't you join the Navy? I mean, when you join the Navy, why don't you join the Navy dive program?" And I'm like, "Really? I didn't even know there were such a thing." And so when I asked my detailer about it, my recruiter about it, she said, "Oh, yeah, well, when you get to officer candidate school, they'll ask for volunteers," which they did. And I just thought, oh, Navy diving, you know, I always want to dive. I'm thinking scuba diving, you know, and recreational diving. Of course, that's not what it is at all. I didn't have any idea what I was getting into, but it just sounded like fun.
So now when you talk about the Navy dive program, you're, at least at this time, you're talking about the big bulky suit with a big round dome on your head and down in dark, murky waters. I don't know. That's just scaring me talking about it.
The first time I had gotten selected for dive school, and I had, there was about 3 months waiting period between the time I left OCS and the time I went to dive school. So it was during the summer from July until November. We were temporarily assigned, several of the people who I went to dive school, eventually went to dive school with, were temporarily assigned to a diving school in Norfolk, Virginia. And because we were going to be going to the school, administration offered to let us do an indoctrination dive on the big hard hat system, which is called the Mark V. The first time I get in the diving dress, the canvas suit that you put on, and then they put the helmet on my head. Well, I was sitting, you know, kind of not really sitting up straight. I was just kind of sitting with my shoulders kind of slumping, and they put the helmet on my head for the first time, and I'm like, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe."
I can imagine.
And so the two men that were with me, they kind of pulled me up by the shoulders and made me sit up straight, and then I'm like, "Okay, that's better."
Oh, gosh.
So it's like 150 pounds, and it's basically all coming down on your head and shoulders so that the helmet won't lift off, you know, your shoulders when you get in the water. So it was a pretty interesting experience.
Oh my gosh. And how many women were in this program, and did you bond with any of them?
Oh yeah, we're all. At the time there was several enlisted women, who I did not know. In fact, I didn't even know there were enlisted women in the program, but not too many, like three or four. And then I went to dive school with a woman named Martha Gray. We were in the same class. There was a woman ahead of us in the class named Sue Truckin, and all three of us made it. And we were the first three women to get into the diving officer program.
Now, that's amazing. Now, were you competitive with each other, or was it more supporting each other?
It was very supportive. I mean, there was no reason to be competitive with each other because we weren't being compared, you know.
Right.
So it was just getting through the program. We're still good friends, even after all these years.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So what did you learn about yourself and your training in the dive program, both physically and mentally?
I realized that I could do a lot more than I thought I could. When I was younger, I really had a lack of confidence in myself and my abilities. And both being in the Navy as a naval officer and a diving officer, showed me that I did have capabilities I wasn't even aware that I had.
And since this is a leadership podcast, how do you get over the urge to just quit and throw in the towel to keep going and finish what you started, whether it's the officer cadet school or a candidate school or the diving program?
Well, you know, you have other people who are there with you who are having struggles as well. I mean, it wasn't a piece of cake for a lot of the people, men and my friend Martha. And Martha was the one who convinced me to stay. You know, there were many times I wanted to quit. And, you know, Martha and I were actually roommates also. And she's like, you can't quit because then I would be there all by myself. So, Darlene, you just got to hang in there one more day. And so then it was like one day at a time.
Yeah, just the small steps. That's amazing.
Absolutely.
So now you're in the Navy, you're in the dive program, you're an officer. Was it your ambition at this time to become a commander of a Navy ship?
Oh, I wasn't even in the cards. At that time in the early 1980s, women had just started being assigned to ships, and that program was struggling along. Lots of issues with fraternization, and I personally think a lot of those issues were because of the lack of leadership at the top, obviously all male leadership at that time, because the men didn't really know how to deal. They weren't taught, they weren't trained, it's not intuitive, how to deal with the women and the men. And, you know, so there was just a lack of leadership at that time. But at the same time, institutionally, the Navy was not allowing women to really go much further. They hadn't really thought long term. And it might have been because of the Vietnam mentality as well. You get in for 2 or 3 years and then you get out. But when you're an officer, you actually have a career path. And when they allowed women to go on ships, they hadn't developed any kind of career path. So a lot of women got out in the early 80s, in the like 83, 84, who had wanted to go to sea because there just wasn't any opportunities after the first tour.
So now that you've been, eventually you were promoted to, I believe it's called an XO, right? Which is the second in command of a ship. And
right.
And did you feel you had a chance to move up to commander at that point, or was it still just you're just going to have to settle for being in the second position?
No, actually, the first inkling that I could possibly have command at sea happened in 1984 when a new class of ship was being built to gender-neutral standards. And that ship class was the ARS 50 class, a safeguard class, which is a ocean-going salvage tug. And that was the kind of ships that my community as a diving officer would go to. There were other of these types of ships in the Navy at that time, but they were old. They'd all been built in the 1940s, just towards the end of World War II, and so they did not accommodate the gender-neutral standards. So when the Navy started building this ship, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, I was at a shore duty command at the time, and I read about this, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is my opportunity to do what my male counterparts are doing. And, you know, I liked being at sea, so I decided I would contact the person who was in charge of my career and say, I would like to go on one of these ships. And so that was when I was on my second ship, the USS Grasp, and as operations officer, then I could see there was a clear path towards command.
And then from what I understand, there was kind of some political stuff going on about who would be the first woman commander in the Navy.
Yeah, that happened a few years later. So I had gone from my operations tour to my executive officer tours. And while I was in the executive officer position, I did get selected for command. But there had been another woman who had been selected for command the year before me. So I never thought that I would be the first woman to have command, because there had been at least one other woman, and she was being, you know, prepped to go to command, but she had gotten, between her executive officer tour and her assignment to command, she had been assigned a teaching position at the up in Newport, Rhode Island. It was a 3-year tour. What wound up happening, and this was all unknown to me until after the fact, the person who, since the diving community is a very small community of at the time, it was less than 500 people out of an officer corps of, I don't know, 100,000 or something. The person who made the assignments to Command at Sea in my community, we didn't have a lot of backup. And so if someone got sick or if someone, you know, just was in their regular rotation to leave command, the assignment officer only had a certain number of people that he could fill those positions. I had actually been selected, but I hadn't been assigned yet. I was told, well, you know, we need to give you a break. How about if we send you to the War College for a year? And I'm like, sure, fine, whatever. Well, then next thing I know, I'm being assigned to the Opportune, and I was going to be going there within the next year. There was like a 9 months worth of school to go to before taking command. So, and it was only later that I found out that there was a little bit of a jockeying for that position.
Yeah. So now you become the first woman commander of a ship in the U.S. Navy aboard the USS Opportune. Explain to me, yep, what you're feeling at the time. I'm just trying to imagine. Is it relief, anxiety, fear, excitement? Well, what's going through in your head?
Obviously, excitement. I mean, it didn't matter when I was going to go. Just the fact that I had gotten selected was very exciting. And my original time to report to the Opportune was in January of 1991. But in November of 1990, there were some rumors about the fact that the captain was ill. And, you know, they were just kind of checking to see how things were going to go. Well, as it turned out, he had a very serious illness. And so I actually got a call it was Christmas Eve of 1990 saying, pack your bags, you're going to Naples on the day after Christmas.
Oh, what a change of plans.
For 26. So I, you know, yes, I had 2 days to prepare. I had already sent some of my stuff to the ship when they deployed because I knew I was going to be going there in January. But I got there about 2 weeks early. And then, of course, about 3 weeks later, Desert Storm started. And so that kind of was a whole nother realm of experience.
So now you have 100 crew members on this ship. They're all men. You're the only woman. And you're their commanding officer. So other than the obvious, what challenges are you faced with right out of the gate?
Well, I didn't have any. It wasn't a problem for me. I was used to being the only person. It was the men who actually had to adjust.
And how did they have to adjust? I mean, from your point of perception, how did they handle it, and how did they adjust?
Basically, they were asking me these really, what I thought, silly questions, you know, because you're going from an all-male ship to suddenly there's a woman on board. Okay, fine, no problem, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I knew enough to be able to go to bed wearing clothes. So if I had to get up in the middle of the night, you know, I would just go up there I usually wore sweatpants and a t-shirt. But the men, it was a little different because I had my own private bathroom facilities, heads. But the men's bathroom facilities were kind of outside of where they slept down the hall. And so one of the first questions that they asked me was, well, Captain, how are we supposed to go to, you know, to the head, you know, with you on board? And I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, what do you mean?
Yeah, silly
like,
question.
Well, you know, usually we'll just get up and we go down there in our underwear. Sometimes we don't wear any clothes. I said, well, you know what? Just put a towel around you. I mean, it's not that hard. But they were all concerned about that. Very concerned about that.
That's interesting. Now, I understand that you piloted the ship in the Eastern Mediterranean at the start of a Desert Storm war in the Middle East.
Yes.
And not only do you have to manage a ship of men, but now you're in the middle of a war. And, you know, things are going on and in the world that you just have no control over. So, you know, kind of from that leadership perspective, how do you manage all that and be the leader that your crew needs you to be?
Well, one of the first problems that I encountered, and I discovered this when I first came on board because the men were very concerned because, you know, Desert Storm had been going on since August, and this now we're in the end of December. And it was pretty obvious things were building up in the Middle East. There had been, of course, in the Iran-Iraq war in the late 80s, talk of biological and chemical weapons. They were very concerned because we didn't have enough gas masks for everybody in the crew. And I had about 106 people on the ship, and we had maybe 80 masks. And so, of course, the first thing I did was, letting my chain of command know that we needed these masks. But in the reality part of it, the people who did not have masks had to go into what we call deep shelter when we went to general quarters, which is not a fun place to be because you're basically stuck in a hold in the bottom of the ship with no windows. And depending on the situation, like, for example, if there had been a nuclear or a biological attack, your ventilation gets shut down. So now you're down in the middle of the ship with no ventilation. And yeah, it's not a fun place to be. But I think that I like to policy for leadership as leadership by example. So I always tried to show, the people who worked for me that I was willing to do whatever it took to get the job done. And a lot of times I actually did it. And then that way, when I asked them to do it, it wasn't, they're like, okay, well, she did it, so it's okay. This went from climbing the mast to obviously diving because I was a diver. I mean, I even went around on Sundays with a spray bottle of cleaner and wiping down the dirty, greasy handprints on the sides of the ship because I just couldn't stand to see, that kind of thing, even though they were supposed to be cleaning every day. But so, I just felt like leading by example was the best way for me to get the job done.
It's I read about a funny story while you were in the Persian Gulf, I believe, and your second command sees a Soviet ship on the horizon. Can you retell that story for us today?
Yeah, actually, we never did get into the Persian Gulf, but we were in the Eastern Mediterranean, and we were stationed right outside the entrance to the Suez Canal, so about 50 miles off the port of Port Said, Egypt. I was down in the salvage hold. We had two exercise bikes down there. I was down there exercising, and the officer of the deck called me up, captain to the bridge, and I'm like, oh, my God. When they call over the loudspeaker, captain to the bridge, you just jump up and go. So I went up there, and, of course, I'm in my workout gear, T-shirt and shorts, and so looking over the horizon, and three Soviet vessels come over the horizon, and we identified them, and I think one of them was the Kirov. And so we're kind of looking at them, and we launch a helicopter. So he comes over on the starboard side of the ship, the right side of the ship, towards the bow, and we're looking at each other. And suddenly over the ship's radio comes a call that they would like to speak to the captain. So I went into the bridge and got on the phone, and they kind of hesitated when I said, this is Lieutenant Commander Iskra. How can I help you? And they're like, we'd like to speak to the captain, please. And I'm like, yes, you're speaking to the captain. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, we're just getting ready to proceed to the Suez Canal and, happy sailing. And like, okay, bye. And so it was kind of like, just one of those what moments.
Who's this person commanding this ship? That's really interesting. So, and then there was another story too that someone was shocked. I believe that you were in Gibraltar and encountered with the British naval admiral. So share with us what happened on that encounter.
So we were getting ready to go into Gibraltar, and when you pull into a port, and the most senior naval authority in the port, you're supposed to do a courtesy call. So the most senior naval authority at the port was this British admiral, because our navy didn't have a presence there, but British had a presence there. And so I had made all the arrangements, via message system about, doing a courtesy call. And of course, I don't use my first name. I just said, Lieutenant Commander D.M. Iskra. So apparently the dude didn't have any idea, even though, frankly, my picture was in the front page of all the newspapers all over the world. So why he didn't have a clue as to who I was kind of surprises me. They actually sent a small boat to come get me, and the person who was running the boat was a woman, which I found kind of surprising too. I was really pleased to see that. And she says to me, "Oh my goodness, I don't think the Admiral knows you're a woman." And I'm like, "Well, I guess we'll find out." So off we go into the main administration building, and the woman kind of hung behind, the sailor hung behind, because she kind of wanted to see the Admiral's face. And it was really kind of humorous, actually, because I walked into the office and, you know, saluted and reported, you know, that I was there, and he just kind of looked at me like, "Where's the captain?" And I'm like, "Sir, I'm the captain." And he was just like, "Oh my goodness," you know. So then he was really embarrassed. But what was interesting, though, is because the British actually had quite a number of women sailors in the Persian Gulf at the time. So the fact that he was kind of surprised to see me was, again, like I said, kind of surprising.
Now, I also am aware that you, you know, we were talking about Desert Storm and during wartime and whatever, but you also did some humanitarian work after Hurricane Andrew when you were the commander of the USS Opportune. So tell us about that experience.
Yes, that was an interesting time as well. We were coming back from towing a decommissioned vessel. We had towed the ex-USS Nathaniel Green, which is a submarine, through the Panama Canal. We were on our way back. And when Hurricane Andrew hit Florida, and so we were told to, you know, to stay in the lee, which was the island of Cuba, and once the hurricane passed, and we pulled into Key West, Florida, and we had one of our towing machines had broken, and so we pulled into Key West, Florida, to embark a couple of people to help repair the machine. And at the same time, the executive officer's brother lived in Key West, and he was like the minister of a church. So his congregation had actually donated a bunch of supplies, and so we unloaded him on the ship because we were going to go up into Miami. So when we got into Miami a little while later, we were able to offload those supplies to people who needed it. But our mission at the time, the Navy mission in that area, was to help prepare the schools to reopen in September, because this happened in August, and the schools in Miami had all been flooded. So the textbooks were soggy, the rugs were soggy, and they're all starting to mildew. So the Navy personnel, there was like a task force of 6 or 7 ships, and the crews would go out to the different schools and just help tear out the rugs and throw the books in the trash and stuff like that. So that was our mission. But because I also had divers on board, we also went into the local community and helped clear some of the marinas and ports, you know, of boats that were in the way of the aids to navigation and that kind of thing. And then a third mission that we had was we helped FEMA. I sent about a third of my crew down into Homestead to help FEMA, help people apply for the FEMA loans.
Is that unusual for the Navy to get involved in humanitarian operations like that, or does that happen frequently?
I think it happened quite frequently. The Navy has, and actually the military in general, has a lot of capabilities that, as you're seeing now with this coronavirus, you know, sending the hospital ships to New York and to Los Angeles to help with, you know, having enough hospital beds. The thing at Hurricane Andrew was they not only had the National Guard there, of course, and that was to help prevent looting, Marines there as well to help people with medical, and they had, you know, food, tents and stuff like that, so that the people who, you know, needed to eat were able to eat, plus, of course, all the workers. That food was supplied to both the workers and to the local community through the military.
Yeah, and as you're right, as we're recording this during the coronavirus pandemic, it's just, boy, we need support in a lot of ways. So at least we do have that capability, the military, to help out.
Yeah, not only that, but this brings me another kind of story. When I was stationed in Guam, I was the civil military liaison officer there, and there was a little island nation called the Republic of Palau, and during one of the storms that they had, they'd get typhoons there, which are basically hurricanes. They had a water line that ran across a bridge from one island to the other. Well, that water line failed, and so we were able to come in and bring water-making equipment to turn salt water into fresh drinking water. So the military also has really unique capabilities to help out in interesting situations.
So did you feel like a pioneer for women in the Navy, or were you just out there doing your job like any other commander would do?
I just felt like I was doing my job until I took command. And because of all the hoopla surrounding it, and, you know, I knew that I was being looked at and scrutinized, you know, very carefully. And so then is when I kind of became a little bit more, well, I should say, I became very aware of my position and my role model position. And so, you know, I felt very concerned about my image. I was very concerned about my decisions. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I wasn't going to get second guessed, which I did anyway, but I really tried to stick to, you know, the guidance that was given and not deviate. Although, you know, you do have the option of educated deviation, but basically, you know, these were the rules, and I really tried to stick by them. I knew that I would be looked at later and criticized regardless, so.
And it sounds like it was a real, it was a real burden in a way of, you know, not just doing your job well, but you had that to deal with as well, which makes doing your job well even that much harder.
It was very onerous, and the fact that I didn't really have anybody to confide in and to talk to about this, you know, made it that much more difficult. Especially, you know, I took command. We're on deployment. We're in Naples, Italy when I took command. And then we went on deployment to towards supporting Desert Storm. You know, and I'm the only woman. You know, there's no other officers of my rank. So it's not like I could really complain and break down in front of any of my troops. I had to remain strong, even with my male peers, because I was competing with them. It was much more difficult to be open with them about the types of things that I was facing. You know, it wasn't my crew that I had problems with. It was my superior officers, as it turned out, that were, you know, really scrutinizing and basically having a hands-off approach, allowing me to either succeed or fail on my own, which I felt was not what they would have done to a male CO. They would have helped guide them a little bit more, I think. But for some reason, for me, I felt like I was out there all alone.
That must have been really hard. Is it different in the Navy now? I mean, how many women commanders are there? And do you think that in today's world, you would have had somebody that you could have talked to and leaned on and asked for mentorship?
You know, it is different now. I don't know how many women have been in command, but there have been many. Social media is a wonderful thing. There is a Facebook group, Women Naval Officers, and most of them are young, but there are people like me and even more senior people than me who are a part of this group, even though we're retired. And, you know, these women feel they have the opportunity, because it's a closed group, to actually come out there and say, hey, I'm having this problem. What do you all think? Whereas I never had that ability to do that. You know, I mean, I would talk to some of my friends and you know, get some ideas, but there wasn't like this ability to go out there and say, hey, I need help, without any repercussions, you know, because it's a private group and it's a very supportive group.
When you look back on your career, what are you most proud of?
Very proud to be a naval officer, very proud to serve my country, and I hope that I serve my country well.
And what about the leadership perspective when leading, as we discussed through this whole program, almost all men in that situation? When you look at that from a leadership perspective, what are you most proud of?
You know, I don't think leadership has gender. You do your job, you take care of your troops, you know, you make sure that they are doing the right thing, and you make sure that you're completing the mission. And that those were my goals, and that's, you know, what I was looking at. Now, the fact that I was a woman, it made a difference to some people, and other people, after a while, they didn't see gender. They just saw the CO, you know, or, you know, the operations officer or whomever. It's an issue only at the beginning until they learn to trust you, but I have been told by men that it's kind of the same with them, that any new person that comes in, you know, the people who serve under you have to believe in you and have to trust you, and that takes a few days or a few weeks or a few months, depending on, you know, the situation.
So you have to earn their respect, and you have to do things that they think are good and think a leader should do. And as long as you perform that, they're willing to grant you that leadership role and follow you, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if a person or a group feels that you're not, you don't have their best interest at heart in terms of fulfilling the mission, then they're not going to trust you, and they're not going to go above and beyond for you. You know, so they have to trust you. They have to trust in your leadership and your ability to do the right thing.
So other than Martha that we talked about earlier in the diving program, do you still have good friends that you forged during your time in the Navy?
Yes, actually, most of the friends that I forged in the Navy, and most of them are women. There is a group, and there is a group called the Women Divers Hall of Fame, which is it's an international group. It's not a military group. And quite a number of my naval diving officer friends are in this group. And if I didn't know them before I got inducted, I certainly know them now. And we're all extremely supportive of each other. It's really fun. It's really nice.
That's great. So now after the Navy, you went on to earn a PhD. And what are you doing now to fill your heart and find your joy?
Yes, I got my PhD in military sociology, specialty gender, work, and family. And that really is still a passion, although I'm not doing any research anymore. What I'm doing to fulfill my passion now is volunteer work. So I volunteer as the Washington State Ambassador for the Women in Military Service for America. And what that entails is educating people about the memorial and educating especially women that they are veterans, regardless of whether they've been in a war zone or not. A lot of women don't think that they're veterans just because, you know, they were a support personnel, you know, but the military runs on support personnel, and it's only a very small portion that are actually at the tip of the spear, and the military wouldn't be able to run without those support personnel. So, you know, it's educating women as to the fact that they are veterans and to encourage them to utilize their veteran benefits.
And now you're also an author of two books, and I understand you might have a third one on the way. What messages are you hoping your readers hear by reading your books?
Lots of times, and even in having studied sociology and particularly military sociology, when you read some of the books that people who have not been in the military have written, it seems like they're looking at women from the victim perspective. You know, oh, they're victims of sexual harassment. They're victims of rape. They're victims of inadequate institutional, you know, support, which is true to a certain extent. But the women who succeed are not victims. Women who succeed are strong and patriotic, and, you know, want to do the best job. So what I'm trying to do with my books is empowering women, is showing that these women are empowered by these things and are able to overcome obstacles and still, you know, move forward and gain, you know, all of the benefits that we have earned over the years.
Do you feel like the Navy and the military generally are learning how to create better and more supportive work environments for women?
Yes, I still think that's ongoing. It is so much better than it was. And I feel that women are very empowered to be able to speak truth to power, so to speak. But at the same time, not just the Navy, but the military in general is a very hierarchical, you know, organization. And, you know, who he who wears the gold rules, right? So you have to be very circumspect as to how you proceed. But the military has come up with ways of reporting abuse and reporting situations that theoretically do not allow for, you know, repercussions. I still think there's some work to do in that regard, but I think for the most part, people are much more willing to, you know, kind of be whistleblowers than they were in the past.
And do you have women coming to you looking for that mentorship and advice that are in the military?
No, not that are in the military. I do have people come to me occasionally, and mostly it's other people who are pursuing an academic requirement. So they might be, you know, researching some aspect of women in the military, and they do come to me and ask for my advice and ask for my review of their, you know, academic pursuits. In fact, not just women, but men as well. I was teaching at Columbia College of Missouri online in a military leadership program, and one of my students is doing his master's work in kind of an military history, archaeology kind of a thing. And he's in Scotland right now. And he had contacted me and asked me if I would help him with his research and his in writing his, you know, thesis and stuff like that. So yeah, and that's very fulfilling to me. I really enjoy doing that.
And in your teaching roles, do you feel that there's a difference in military leadership versus leadership, you know, outside of the military?
Not having ever served in the corporate world, this is a speculation on my part. Men's leadership been kind of autocratic. You know, it's like I'm the boss, and I'm, you know, I'm putting down the word down the chain of command, so to speak. And I think that this is true in the corporate world as well. And you can kind of see that with our current president. I mean, he's a corporate guy. You know, he's used to being in charge. He's used to having people follow him regardless. In the military, that was the way it was as well. In the mid-1980s, actually maybe late 1980s, early 1990s, the military role started changing because of the different types of leadership in the civilian sector. Total quality management, you know, 7 steps to highly successful people, you know, those kinds of things, if you recall those coming out back then. The military actually started changing from an autocratic to a more inclusive type of leadership style, which is really what, in all of the leadership literature I've read about the differences between men's style of leadership and women's style of leadership, it's really more conducive to a woman's style of leadership, more inclusive, you know, more asking for their opinions and then taking it all in and making a decision. Even though you'd think in the military that, you know, you don't want to rule by, you know, democracy majority, because that doesn't work in a wartime environment. You know, the fact is, in most situations, it's not life or death. So if you're in a training command, for example, I mean, you can gather input from your subordinates as to how you can best serve this, you know, community or whatever. So there has been changes, and I think that both the civilian and the military side of leadership is evolving kind of in the same manner.
That's very interesting. Darlene, usually at this time of the interview, I ask my guests for a pearl of wisdom. So in relation to leadership, what can you leave us with today, which is your pearl of wisdom?
Well, my pearl of wisdom is to, you know, always do the right thing. And as far as, you know, leadership is concerned, I think if you're always looking to do the right thing and to take care of your people, then you hopefully will be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Darlene, this has been just a real pleasure talking with you. I'm just so impressed. I mean, it is a big deal that you're the first woman commander of a Navy ship. And it's something that to be real proud of, and I feel a very proud that I was able to interview you, having served that role. So thank you for your service to our country, and thank you for leading the way for other women. And this was a very interesting discussion, and thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.